Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Spring Podcast. As usual, we'll kick off with just saying thanks to everyone for tuning in over the last few weeks. Some really good feedback from people there. As I said, great to see you're enjoying it. And we seem to have listeners from all over the globe somehow. I don't know what it was. The last time I checked, there was someone in Singapore listening. So shout out to you, whoever you are. I hope you're enjoying a lot of Irish lads looking back into the past. So we've Tommy back with us once again.
Well, how are things? We've gone international.
We have. And we've Art McCarrick, familiar to listeners from episode 2. He's back with us once again.
Yeah, I was delighted to get the call up again. I've been studying up there and just delighted to get off the bench and hopefully do a good job with the team.
Yeah. Good stuff. He's been training hard. So
that's it for sure.
Not sure what the crack with him is again. I think his dog ate his homework or some bullshit like that.
Is that for buying a house?
He did a while back. Yeah, sure.
I was going to say something about that, but no, I won't.
It's also his birthday, so yeah, we gave him the day off. He deserves one day off for his freeloader.
I'm sure his Argentinian anecdotes were worthy of a day off.
Yeah, no, you're dead right. Like he spent a lot of money to get over there and do some underground reporting for us. Granted, no, he missed the rally by about 6 months. But sure, he got there and he drove the stages. So
I think he's actually in hiding from the car rental companies because he's actually out his behaviour.
Yeah.
He's the reason we can't get super insurance anymore.
As I said, it's his birthday, so happy birthday to him. How old is he now? He's like fucking 52 or 3, is he? I don't know.
God, he must be about 80, is he?
Yeah, he's gone shook now. Jesus, the lockdown is hitting him hard, but sure, look. Anyway, so we're still in lockdown and we're still kind of learning more and more about the effects of this pandemic in the world of motorsport. It's been a pretty interesting week in terms of cancellations and that. We've had our own domestic Tarmac Championship cancelled, which is probably inevitable the way things were looking with like the majority of the events being pulled. But it's still, you know, it's still kind of a shock to see. You just got the email there yesterday or the day before from Troa. So
I think it's been met really with widespread agreements. I don't think anyone can argue about it. We're a sport that really, it's good that we've stood up and in Ireland and shown that, okay, we know our place in this and we have to stand back. And it's good that we've shown that bit of social responsibility too. So it's looking unlikely for some events, but I actually know more about it. But yeah, that'd be my view on it.
Yeah, and I think as much as it's been socially responsible or whatever, it has to be practical too. And I'm sure as and when things become a little bit clearer, unfortunately, you know, maybe other championships will do the same. And you know what that Troa statement did say is, with the Ulster being postponed, you know, there's so many things postponed and not yet rescheduled that we can't realistically commit to having a championship because there'd be so many championship rounds in on top of each other and it wouldn't be right to do that. So they're saying, you know, if the events can find a way of running, great. And I wonder now, like, it's getting very close to the stage where, like, I see, you know, Rally Poland there postponed today. So that means the first 5 rounds of the European Rally Championship have been postponed. And what is the next round coming up? It would have been Poland. The next round coming up is Latvia, which is one of the earlier ones, which has been rescheduled, but the date still hasn't been confirmed yet. And the round after that is in Italy. And, like, you're looking at that And I know they keep saying we're postponing. Like, we're heading into the fifth month of the year now. Like, there's no way you can shoehorn everything from the first half of the season into the second half. It just will not fit. But there's lots of, like, you really do, you have to go delving in through the international sporting code and everything to see, you know, how many rounds it takes for something to be viable and stuff. And I'm sure that's what FIA championships are holding out for anyway. But
no, I think you're right. I think at this stage, it's highly likely that we won't see anything happen of major note this year.
Yeah, and like if you think about it, like, even just, you know, how do you, like, if you could have a rally with no spectators, you know, like, you have a driver and a co-driver in very close proximity.
Yeah.
The car still has to be scrutineered. It has to be serviced. You know, if some fella rolls it and, you know, you need to patch it up before service, is there going to be an FIA lad standing there with a measuring tape making sure the mechanics are 2 meters apart? Like, it's...
Yeah, it's you've got the other side of it as well, where, you know, God forbid, there's an issue needing the emergency services yeah, in, like, and there's the argument there, are we just taking people away from where they're needed more for the sake of let's face it, is a minority sport. Within a minority sport, rallying is a minority interest within motorsport, which itself is a minority sport when you, in the grand scheme of things. So, like, we have to, you know, as much as into the sport as we are. I have to say I support whatever decisions these people make, and if it means that, look, we come back better next year. Kind of a clearer run of things than the same, but the priority at the moment is just keeping people safe, and running a rally in the middle of this is definitely not going to be conducive to that. So,
David Richards was on the Autosport podcast, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, or could have been last week. I was listening to it on Sunday, and they were making the point that the MSA, our counterparts, Motorsport UK, our counterparts in the UK, where they were struggling to rationalize it, like we've just said, was you already have frontline services that have been at full stretch, and you have the likes of something like the British Grand Prix, or, you know, potentially BTCC rounds, things like that, and they were finding it hard to justify from, you know, a social point of view, of you already have these people who have been working on the front line fully stretched in the medical services in a country where the figures are going up. Yeah. And then trying to justify, you know, taking these services and reallocating them to something which is, in the scheme of things, in the bigger picture, what we're looking at right now isn't quite as important, you know.
Yeah, and it's understandable, you know, that not many of the bigger championships yet have made, yeah, look, we definitely can't do it. The whole thing is canned. Because the sand is shifting under their feet every couple of weeks at the minute. But it is going to get to a stage, and I think it will be purely down to time that's left in the year to go, this actually isn't workable now. At the minute, they're still working because there is, you know, whatever, 7-8 months left in the year or whatever. So you can kind of think, okay, that's what we have left. But it's not really. And
we saw kind of a similar situation with Australia last year.
Very close to it, yeah.
Like, there's so much other pressures happening, and the same thing happened again in Australia, funnily enough, with the F1 this year back in March. There's so much, like, other factors influencing the people that are making these decisions, and you can, a lot of the time, you can see that these, you know, really high level sports with massive sponsorship money involved and professional competitors and whatever, and teams and whatever the case may be, they're living in a bit of a bubble of kind of their own making, which is understandable. You know, they're all traveling together. So, you know, I wouldn't say they're insulated from the outside world, but there's definitely a bit of a detachment thing going on, and that's probably a factor in this as well. Like, there's been a couple of world rounds pulled as well. I think Portugal just talked about it. I'm not sure if it's been confirmed yet. Finland is on a knife edge by all accounts. I think the legislation in Finland dictates that they only have a month kind of stable outlook at a time, but the indications are that there could be a bit of trouble coming there. F1 is obviously in turmoil, as we said, and something that's probably worried me than more than any of these things being pulled, because rallies will return, national championships and stuff will return. Where I see the issue happening, and this happened during the last recession as well, was manufacturers pulling out.
Yeah.
I just heard during the week that Audi pulled out of the DTM, which is a big, big problem for that sport or for that championship, because for anyone that's unfamiliar with the DTM, is the one of the premier, kind of the quickest series for touring cars in the world. It's the German series. And they had been trying to do some crossover with Super GT in Japan and I think supercars in Oz and stuff like that. But they traditionally had the premium German manufacturers were keeping the series going. And now BMW are the only ones left because Merck pulled out a couple of years ago and I think Aston were only in it for a year or something. To be honest, I don't follow that closely. As spectacular as the cars are and those great drivers and stuff like that, it's one of them series that when you put it on the telly, they manage to make it look shit. But it's still,
it's true though. Yeah.
But anyway, I digress.
You are right though in what you're saying. And sorry, I don't mean to cut across yet, but that's the commercial realities of this, is that they could see that they could do without motorsport. That's the danger. Manufacturers might end up in that school of thought that we could do without this, in the midst of all this.
I think Audi, the press release called it a reshuffling or a recategorization of, there was some PR fucking shite speak anyway for saying we're in trouble, lads, basically. Like, and we've seen
and that's never good when it comes mid season or middle of the year, when it's not a November or December decision. when it's an April decision, you're like,
The Volkswagen Group have form in this, as we've seen over the last number of years. They pulled Porsche out of Le Mans. Or the Villain P1, they obviously pulled Volkswagen out of the WRC, as we've talked about previously. But I just worry that, if you look at the fallout from the last time we had a global recession back in 2008, we had Subaru and Suzuki pull out of wall rallying at the time. If you look at the broader picture, F1, you had Honda, Toyota pulled out not long after. I think they did 2009, they pulled out after that, but it was... The shockwaves from this are going to be felt for a long, long time, and we're in a situation at the moment with the WRC where things were on the downturn before any of this kicked off. As we said previously, I think you might have said it, Tommy, where is the queue of manufacturers beating down the door to come in? There isn't. We're left with three.
Potentially though, we're on the cusp of something either terribly negative, or you can turn that negative into a positive, because clearly the resources and the capital will not be there to allocate in the same quantities as they have been for the last couple of years at the top tier of the sport for Formula One and the WRC. And look, I think we touched on it I alluded to, there's already a ready-made category there with cars that are ready to go, really. Formula One needs to cut its cloth as well, because it's the budgets are ridiculous.
I think there's a word for this. It's crisis opportunity.
Yeah.
It's a very crumbling word.
My most sincere contributions, Morris.
But anyway, we've spoke about the R5 stuff before, and I don't think it got too far down the road of misery as we kind of did last week with some of this stuff. But we have a situation at the moment where some of the drivers are coming out and saying that they're not happy with the new rigs, and there doesn't seem to be a clear path forward in terms of what's actually definitely coming in 2022 with the new cars and stuff like that. And there's just too much up in the air at the moment. There was too much up in the air before this kicked off.
And I can see that 2022, deadline been pushed back here. I've seen it's happened in other disciplines. It's happened with rallycross, and I think F1 have pushed theirs back a year too. just logistically, and in order to give potentially a new manufacturer that might be interested in coming in, or to curry favor with the ones that are there or whatever, or heaven forbid, maybe the reason they're not publishing too much is they might do a complete U-turn and go down the road, you know, you're talking about, you know, needs must, you know, Group B was cancelled with the stroke of a pen. And Group A was already there, you know, they didn't wait to create a new category, there was already Group A there. So maybe something like that happens, instead of going down the road of ploughing on with a new category, like Group S was planned after Group B, shelve it, stop the one we have, and, you know, kind of reinvigorate an existing class of car. And maybe, like, that's obviously absolute on the ditch talk, but there could potentially, with the way things could be economically and all over the world with this, like the price of oil has gone down. So it's not as if you're going to have, like in 2009 and 2010, it's not as if you're going to have Qatar and Abu Dhabi and all of them coming in loads of money to back teams after a financial crisis. Yeah. It's not going to happen this time. Like, so.
Yeah, it's a real shit show. Let's be honest. It's a fucking mess. And like, we might, you know, we're taking a very kind of a close look at it here, just, you know, on the sport we're into. Obviously, you know, it goes without saying that this affects people in much, much worse ways than this. But, you know, we're not medical experts. No, we're not really experts either by any stretch, but we can talk away about this kind of stuff without getting lambasted on social media. We hope, anyway. Sure,
well, it could be... it could be a real turning point for motorsport. We've already been we've been teetering on this edge of, you know, do we go hybrid, do we go electric, the sports. I think to do either of those things completely is to jump the gun completely, but it's not sustainable. They talk about sustainability in a lot of the FIA's latest communications, and Motorsport UK, when they've been having this forward, the hashtag behind it, I can't remember which one it was, but sustainability was the thing that they were, and relevance that they were pushing for. In reality, sustainability isn't ploughing excess money to go into technologies that could potentially bankrupt preparation firms, or, you know, manufacturers don't have it to put into it.
Less is more. The car industry as a whole, is suffering, you know, it was suffering.
And I can tell you the margins aren't in new cars, and I can tell you that personally, they're not in them.
Yeah, look, we won't solve it here, but like, all I'll say is, surprisingly, we won't. Maybe we can do an offshoot podcast where we fix the problems, but anyway.
Question time with Nick Kershaw.
But, no, like I will say one thing, and I kind of got the sense at the Monty last year that what we were witnessing was, and the other rounds have been to since this, the new cars came in, the 2017 cars came in, that this was the kind of once in a lifetime sort of, you know, mix of really, really quick drivers with decent manufacturer involvement and spectacular cars, and you know, everything came together. And it's rare enough, it's kind of once in a generation that you have that mix, as we've seen. You know, rallying, like any sport, is cyclical due to various factors. But I just felt, you know, even though we were enjoying it immensely, there was just this kind of nagging feeling that this is going to be over soon, and to try and get to as many rounds as we could before it did. And as we've seen now, it is starting to kind of crumble in front of us. But hopefully we'll be able to get to a couple of rounds next year before the rules change again. Finland is definitely one on the list, I think, before these things. But I feel so lucky, and this is something I've been telling my grandkids about, was, you know, this generation of rally car with these drivers, and like, we're so lucky to see him, the pace, everything the cars were spectacular.
I was only thinking that very same thought today about going, because this will be the first year in a good few years that I haven't gone to a world championship round of any variety. And I went to Finland in 2017 and it was unbelievable. And if things get better or clear up or whatever next year, that's the one I would go to in a heartbeat.
I'm still to see I keep calling the 17 car because obviously the regs came in. Like, I was lucky to visit around in 2010 for the last year, the 2 litres. I am quite jealous of the fact that I haven't gone to see these new cars. So I want to be able to, like you say, like both of you are saying, have witnessed them with your own eyes and ears and feel that bang in the chest that you get, you know, when you hear this thing coming past you.
And there is something about those kind of cars been driven, even the earlier generation world cars and stuff. But when I heard those new cars, the 17 generation cars in action coming towards you, it actually sounds like the engine is going to come out of the thing. Like, they're driving them that hard. It's unbelievable. Like, it's like nothing you've ever heard or seen.
There is something manic about them that was missing, I think, in the earlier generation 1.6 liter WRC cars. You know, they just have the right blend. The only, maybe this is a weird thing to miss about them, but I miss the smell, right? They're obviously running them, you know, a lot more efficiently and running the anti lag and stuff a lot more efficiently than they did in the older stuff. But I do miss the smell of fucking racing fuel. And I think in the Monte last year, the Citroen was the only one that had a bit of a kind of a home off it. The rest of them were running clean. And I must say, that was one thing I used to love about the 2 litre cars was the bang of fuel. Fucking to poison you if you're around it for too long, because seriously knocks the stuff. Like, I was at Rally Legend in Italy there, another crazy event, and one we'll do a podcast in the near future as well, because we've all been to that, and that's one that everyone should go to at least once. But there was a blast of the 206 WRC cars there, like just, Jesus, 4 or 5 of them anyway, and we were on a start line. We'd been there for pretty much 2 hours probably at that stage, watching all the Group E stuff in the middle of the night. Oh, it was just crazy. But whatever fuel the 206s were running and whatever way they were mapped, oh man, I had to go away from it. Eyes streaming, headache, fucking sore throat, the whole lot. It was just lethal stuff. But yeah, it's part of the drama. Is that, and as you said, the thump and the chest from the anti-lag or whatever, like as I said, with things, you know, the push to make things greener and more efficient and stuff, that stuff we've seen it with F1 already, you know, that the noise and the spectacle is going to reduce. It's probably not going to get better than what it is, so we're very lucky to have witnessed these.
But you see that, look, it's diminishing returns then, because obviously the thing that attracts people to the sport is going, if you take away some of the strongest elements of it, you know the attraction falls away a bit. And Formula 1, you can argue that, you know, all the cars know the sound doesn't matter, people expect a racing car to sound a certain way. They expect a rally car to sound a certain way. It's a music. It's like, I'm quite vocal about certain things in terms of noise. If it's louder, it's generally better in my view. 11, everything, it has to be at 11. That's the way I look at it. Well, it's the same like any music you hear now. There's a trend towards the BPM of records. If you study it, BPM records has actually slowed down in the last 10 years. I don't know, is that people can't cope with the urgency or, you know, the speed.
It's because Scooter haven't put out an album. Scooter haven't put out an album in like the last 10 or 12 years.
Scooter were driving the average away up.
they were.
It's a load of mammy's boys, isn't it? Nathan Carter and Nate Sheehan or whatever.
Scooter and Hermes House Band were just playing with it, like just ratcheting it up for everyone.
Yeah, obviously taking their...
I'll take her word on that one. Now, I don't know if those two... I knew Scooter, but their Hermes fans, not one I'm familiar with.
They're obviously taking some influences from Gabber and all those sort of fucking crazy offshoots of techno that came out there.
Gabber, I thought I'd forgotten about that, and I wish I had until you brought
it up. Yeah, there you go. No, actually, there's a nice little offshoot for someone. a nice little diversion there for someone if we're introducing you to the obscure genres, terrible in most
go,
cases.
Go put on The Age of Love by The Age of Love to clean your ears out after this podcast, and everything will be awesome.
Maybe we'll do a someone's podcast. Try and tie some bit back into writing if we can in the future. But we better not. Dave Daly, he actually enjoyed the shout out.
Of course he did.
Yeah. So he's trying to divert a bit of flack off himself now and hoping that we don't ridden him again. But sure.
Actually, I must give a shout out to Lawrence DeSola, who does lots of good sim work on YouTube. Just want to anyone who's interested in setting up sim rigs and, you know, looking to see how it's done right. Some of the stuff that Lawrence has up is brilliant. He gave me a lot of help there this week, so I just wanted to give Lawrence a quick plug there.
Oh yeah, Lawrence is a decent guy. Shout out to him. Yeah, he's a good guy. Big into his Nissans as well.
He has Datsuns.
A couple of tasty S13s. Cool looks. No, I know he's got a good setup. His channel has gone pretty well. What's the name of his channel? I better look it up there now and give him a proper shout out.
If we're giving him a plug, we may as well do it right.
Yeah. He's not sponsoring this week, is he? Sure he's not.
He's not, no. He provided help in every way, but bare financial.
God damn it. I believe Artis hooked us up once again, is he?
Who's our sponsor this week?
I think you'll be able to unveil it later on.
Okay, we'll keep it in the wraps off later on. Yeah, so
it'll reveal itself, will it?
Yeah, Lawrence's channel is imaginatively enough titled Lawrence the Solo. So it's just his name as well. So no, shout out to him. So
does what it says in the team.
Yeah. So well, I suppose will we go to Cyprus? I suppose we will.
Yeah.
Let's go to Cyprus.
Have any of you actually been to Cyprus? Like, obviously, you know, not necessarily for the rally, but just on a holiday or whatever. No.
No. Although you think going to a troubled partition island would appeal to an Irish person, but no, I've never been.
I kind of forgot about that actually. Yeah, that's
a bit. Yeah, there's a whole UN. There's a whole UN buffer zone and everything in the middle of the country. And northern half is Turkish and the other half is Greek Cypriot or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Bit of history there. Yeah. We won't get into that now for fear of drawing ever more issues upon ourselves.
They didn't go for the Rally Ireland model of cross-border funding anyway. They kept it all in the south of the island.
Fucking Rally Ireland. God. let's not get into that again. Jesus. save all the frustration there for a future podcast on Rally Ireland.
Yeah.
But, anyway. So Cyprus. I just remember back in the day when it was around, like, you'd look forward to the whole WRC season, you know, obviously. There were some rallies you'd look forward to more than others. You'd obviously, the Monty defeat, it would be a fever pitch because it was the first round again after the break. You know, the classics like Sweden and, you know, Finland. Jesus, Finland would be, you know, one of the absolute highlights. And then, you know, if there was a title battle going to GB, you know, you'd be buzzing for that as well. For some reason, not for some reason, I know why, because it was slow as fuck. Cyprus and a couple of other rallies like that, I wouldn't say I was dreading him, but I definitely didn't have the same excitement kind of looking into him because, like, it just looked like torture for the crews, like the heat and the dust and, like, the average speeds were like, the lowest of any event. Like, they were really, I think, going just over 60 kilometers an hour in some cases. Like, sure, you couldn't even get air into the car at that speed. Like,
but physically, they said it themselves about the temperatures that the drivers were having to endure. Because the technical nature of the roads, you see with the low average speeds, it was just corner into corner into corner into corner. Like, the exertions that it was putting on guys were unbelievable, like, when you look at it, because
it was a bit like Corsica on gravel in like a cooker or something.
A Stanley range there that you're driving around the place. Yeah.
In the case of
a Skoda.
Yeah, and it was lucky in a way that this kind of, you know, it was the era, as we said before, where drivers were really becoming, you know, full on athletes. You would have had to have been to cope with this, because this was, this, you know, I think, was it Sainz mentioned or McRae mentioned? So, a crazy amount of weight loss, just through sweat, like, you know, kilos and kilos of fluid lost during the day.
I'm fairly certain as well that 2000 was the first year that they had to wear all the gear. Or 2001, sorry, this year. The previous year, I seem to remember something with Saints and the Acropolis, where he was giving out, you know, he was wearing his T-shirt and he was told that he shouldn't be wearing it or whatever. And I think in 2001, they brought in the rule that you had to wear your overalls no matter how hot it was. There was no safari T-shirt and shorts crack anymore.
I think you're right. I think you're right, yeah.
Ford used to have the split suits. Yeah, yeah. The top half. But I definitely remember something with Sainz in 2000. He was driving for Ford anyway, and it wasn't in 2001, so it must have been then. And because you can just look at the footage of them in service, and they're all clinging to shadows under trees and wearing towels on their heads, like, oh, it must have been torture.
Yeah, I think the split suit was and is still homologated because it's used commonly in the US, and they used them, I think, in Safari that year and the year after. But,
do you remember you could actually buy replicas of the split suits of the top element of them? I remember in Motor Factors around the time, you could buy a Sparco Martini Racing Ford one, like looked like a replica, like of the overalls, like. But I remember it was 200 and something euros at the time. It was scandalous money to look shit, like, you know, to someone, you know, to be.
I got a Subaru one late.
Lately, was it? Did you buy that out the back of a stall at the Plough? Did you?
No. It took a lot of hunting down. It's an official Sparco proper SWRT one, and it's not actually aligned to any driver. It's not Burns or Kankin, and it's literally an SWRT one.
You should get Ackham Mortal or Tashi Ari printed on it. That'd be fucking.
Yeah, Ackham Martel, that might be the one to go.
One hit wonder.
Power horse, world rally
power horse.
Yeah. Hit being the term for it. As
what a name for an energy drink that was.
Power horse.
It was on the Arrows car when Verstappen was racing it too, I think.
It was the best
energy drinks company name there ever was.
Yeah, there's some strong names now for
hype.
Fucking
Dark hell, Dog.
Dark Dog. Yeah.
Jeez, are they not sponsoring us this week, Dark Dog?
They're not.
No, but Aaron. They might chip in at some stage. No, we've got a more nautical sponsor this time.
Go for it.
Captain Birdsey, is it?
Go on, spill the beans.
We're just chatting to Freddie Dorr there, and we've got a Sosima on board, and I need to look up what Sosima stands for. It's his shipping company that he was CEO of anyway. The Swiss-based company, Société de Services Maritimes.
Excellent.
They sorted out all the transport to and from the rally. We're going to try a like and share competition for a chemical tanker, but it's not going to happen.
Well, do you know, if you can give me...
Or 20 million, you need to sell someone the tickets for that.
You can give me an old empty container, you know, to use as a shed, I'd be happy with that.
Yeah,
see, because Freddie was doing Cyprus, you see, so kind of made sense for the company to... Because he wasn't putting anything on the rally car, like, so he said he put something towards the podcast.
Jeez, fair play to him, that he's a decent bloke. 19 years after the event, he's still fucking coughing up. But,
What a guy!
Yeah, actually, yeah. Jeez, an old tanker now would be handy at the moment if we were able to buy some of that fucking cheap oil and hold on till
you wouldn't have to buy it. They give it to you.
You're right. Yeah, they'd literally pay you to fucking take it away.
The tanker would pay for itself.
Jesus, yeah. Anyway, look, that's just fair play to you. That's better than any other sponsor. We can buy as many lawnmowers as we want now of Harry. So
yeah, that's a big shout out to Sosina there.
Yeah, no, big cool. Yeah, the podcast is going big now because of this, hopefully. Although well, probably won't, let's be honest. Sure, look.
Where are we sitting after Argentina, Morris?
Where are we sitting?
Point-wise in the challenge.
Oh, you caught me in the hop there, kid. I'm going to have to do some frantic EWR.
I have it prepared.
Ah, come on. Go on, step in.
Mackinnon leading on 27 points. Sainz, the old dog, second on 22. Then Robin Pera, Oriel and McCrae tied in third, all on 10 points. And then Delacour and Burns tied on 9 points.
Very good. Very good. Mackinnon, yeah, again, strong start to the season. We did a bit of a recap there before we got into Argentina, eventually got into Argentina in the last episode. But yeah, he was after a very decent start and signs as well, just sort of sheer fucking doggedness. But fair play to him. Obviously, McRae had won the rally in Bourne second, so they'd finally got their seasons into some bit of shape. But there's a few interesting bits for the intro list. There was a huge quantity of World Rally cars again, like, and just generally A cars. Like, it was nearly half the entry, I think, was it? Or even more?
Yeah, 37.
Yeah, a total entry of 76 cars, and 37 of them were A8 cars.
Whoa, that's like that's some money. Like, as in, just sheer euro value of car to have one place. Crazy, like, and to run them, like, and you know, they definitely weren't, very cheap compared to today's cars. I'd nearly say that they weren't far off the running costs, if even some bit equivalent, you know, accounting for inflation and all that kind of stuff. You know, there was huge stuff.
And you had, I'd say for the first time in quite a while, you had 1, 2, 3, 4, you had five of the teams running three cars. Skoda were the only team to run two cars. Subaru drafted in Tashi Arai, so he came in. Mitsubishi had Taguchi, who did the British Championship the following year or some of it. He led Scotland and rolled it into a ball. Derek Ringer was sitting in with him.
I think there's something in that though, because Arai was only after winning a rally back in Japan, I think they call it the Alpine Rally, but I think that was a candidate round. There was two rounds that were candidate rounds that year in Japan. They were trying to get it in. So they brought Arai and Taguchi,
The Alpine Rally was a tarmac round, from what I remember, and they went for the gravel round back in the day, and it's been a topical now at the moment, because they're obviously trying to, well, Rally Japan was scheduled to run this year, but will or not is another question, but it's a tarmac round again.
Was it Hokkaido was the other one, was it?
I think it could have been
above in the north of Japan, wasn't it?
I think you're right. And then there was the other element of it too, because it seemed to happen on these kind of events and the Acropolis. You would bulk up your team, because there was a chance if someone kept their nose clean, they would get into the top, you know, five or six and get a few manufacturer points or driver's points or whatever. You tended to see that on the rougher events. Not that you would bring in the specialist, but it was a good event to kind of blood someone, or if you are a Japanese manufacturer, you know, get a Japanese person in the car. You know, it was like you used to have the Japanese guys for Toyota doing the Safari and stuff. And of course, Hyundai drafted in that long event, rough specialist. What the feck is his name?
Pierre Liatti.
Pierre Liatti, that's him.
The known rough rally.
Absolutely. They, in their infinite wisdom, drafted him in to be their third driver.
Did somebody not get an email mixed up back in MSD or something?
Very good agent.
There must have been a lot of guys at that time, because like Kankinen in 2001, 2002 was past it, and he got in for a good few spins with Hyundai. We haven't even got to this day. I think it's another 2 or 3 years before Stig Blomqvist re-signs for Skoda.
Was that 2002, I think?
2002 or 2003, yeah.
2002, yeah. Stig was there with the Octavia.
Stig was doing the lot of rallies in the PWRC in an Evo this year.
He did this event, yeah.
Yeah,
so
Stig was building up to a full-time trying to break back into the full-time factory seat doing the PWRC.
It was just like those kind of teams on the fringes were, you know, desperate to go to the board to say, oh, look, we have a World Rally Championship winning driver, or someone who's won or led a World Rally Championship event in our team. Like, that must have been the only reason, because they were never going to be quick.
Answer me this, though. Why did Gabriel Pozzo get a drive with Skoda? And why did, well, I know why Roman Cresta did, because he was Czech or whatever, like, but you know.
Lewis Clement got it.
Lewis Clement, he just didn't do well at all, did he?
There's some fairly interesting things when you go down through the field here. I suppose it speaks more for the beauty of homologation, really, back in the day of Group A and Group N. In Class N4, there was actually 26 entries to add to the 37 that Ark mentioned already. And there was a few interesting people popped up there. Ben Bryant, who featured in our youth many times on Blue Peter with rally features, he popped up to do it. Mark Higgins was there. You said already, Stig Blomqvist. Francois Duval, in one of his earlier outings in an Evo branded as a Charisma GT. And
big Balgo support, I think, at the time. He was running an Evo in the Belgian Championship in kind of colours that were the same as the Waxcat, or the Group A Waxcat. So
I vaguely remember seeing RPM and he popping up in Luxembourg or something.
And he got as far as stage two.
Did he?
Yeah.
Wouldn't be like him.
Did he just not bother doing the rest, or he just couldn't be arsed?
Just the camel pack or whatever wasn't hooked up and he threw a
hissy fit.
I spotted two interesting ones in Group N. There's a guy here, those of you that would know your rally history, the Trabant wouldn't be a traditionally successful rally car, but it's finished several RAC rallies. And the driver whose hands it usually was in was a German guy called Michael Kalfus. He was doing the rally in a Group N Civica GT4, and probably one of the final outings for the much maligned Nissan Sunny GTIR, must have been really stretching the end of its homologation, was in the hands of Edith Weiss, also doing Group N.
Must have been stretching the limits of the cooling system there too.
Oh man, that thing must have just boiled itself asunder on the start ramp.
Oh God, could you actually imagine a worse car to do it in?
Oh man.
Well, in Class N2, there was a Hyundai Accent. I can't imagine that was much better. In one, somebody brought along a Swift Twin Cam 16 valve.
Hi, don't be giving all
the flying machine.
Great. There's more with that car later. More will be revealed.
Oh, we've got a diversion of way.
A Clio in Class 3, standard enough. Clios. But what I love is in Class A5, there's only three starters. A 106, a Skoda, and a Toyota Starlet, but it isn't even a Skoda Felicia, it is a Skoda Favorite. So clearly, lads absolutely doctoring their homologation logbooks to stretch them to the final day to do their local, international, or world event.
Fair play to them. So we've got this like first half of the field is just top notch, freaking international drivers and works teams and privateer, you know, WRC cars, and then you just have lads.
There's something lovely and romantic though about when you look back to these days of the World Rally Championship, where you could still do it if you had something within homologation. It wasn't beyond the realms of possibility.
That's the thing, like, and you know, the sport as a whole was definitely more accessible back then. Like, you're looking at the cars that were being used in, you know, in homologation times, or when they were within their homologation, they're the ones that are still being used for guys that are at an amateur level, especially here and stuff. But there's a couple of 106s, you'd struggle to get a 106 around a one-day national tarmac rally at home without it fucking falling asunder, let alone 2 days in Cyprus.
Yeah, I'm just talking car 55 Kipros Cipriano Peugeot 306 Maxi. Oh,
what?
Yeah. Last one. Yeah.
Oh man.
God.
That must have broken. Fucking hell.
I can't see how he finished.
Did he ever surface again after that? No, that's anything.
Oh man, Suzuki Baleno there in Class A6.
Yeah.
Not the estate version, which was also homologated as a rally car. I found out today.
Yeah, you tweeted about that. I got a good old buzz after that, York. No.
Monster Tajima.
Yeah.
Of Pike's Peak.
We're sad men, aren't we?
and an Opel Corsa B as well.
Nice. There was a Civic and, yeah, the 106. Yeah, there was four starters in that class,
And four different cars. Great bit of variety, like.
Are we going to do this? The first rally that gets going back over here, are we going to spend fucking half an hour talking about the interlist the way we're doing
here? I think
I think we will, yeah. I think we'll just be so overjoyed to have something, anything running again.
We're embracing diversity. We're modern, progressive people.
We are. No, definitely. This is a left-leaning podcast.
So, it is. The tracking is out, basically. So.
There was a couple of just interesting kind of interludes. They used to do them back then. They were kind of cool on the coverage as well back then. We were treated to Derek Dauncey, I think is how you pronounce it.
I think you're right.
Been on the Absolute Rally podcast, and he's actually very interesting, the guy to follow on Instagram. He would have been with Rally Art at the time, and he's worked with other teams as well. And he's got some very, very cool stories from back in the day, but they did a clip of how they got the cars from the UK over to Cyprus and the ferry, as we said. And we also were treated to the edifying sight of Marcus Granholm painting some timber at home. So it was nice to see that he's not just some, you know.
Harry gave him the turps, though, to be fair. So
did Harry hooked him up there with some discount
turps and turps and white spirits. Harry had it in stock as well.
Does Harry have a pair of deliveries at the moment? Because just it's impossible to get out now of a fucking co-op.
Should say he probably has drones now at this stage for delivery.
Yeah. Red Bull branded drones. Mm. Anyway, let's get into the event itself. As we said, stages that did not look the nicest to be driving by any stretch of the imagination. Tight, twisty, rocky, gravelly, just not really driver stages. Is it very technical? And very sore on cars and crews in general. Like in the Fords, they had just like little fans strapped to the cage, where the roof it was, just to try and get that bit of extra airflow around the car. So as I said, most guys would have had just leaves rolled up. I even see like Burns on the road sections was basically down to his jocks with the freaking overalls hanging out the window, trying to dry the sweat off him. You know, it's just,
McRae opted not to wear gloves at times. I don't know how the FIA would have looked at that. But...
Ah, Gwyndaf Evans style.
Yeah.
So this is better than Andrew Nesbitt's golf, you know, at least he was honest about it. Nesbitt used to wear, was it golf gloves he used to wear, was it?
It looked like a glove that you would put on if you were going to swing a driver, yeah.
Yeah.
It looked like Big Earn's glove from the film Kingpin.
Yeah. I wonder where they have alligators. I don't know. Shocking scandal again. News, breaking news from fucking decades ago. But anyway, so actually, just at the itinerary, it was unusual. They actually had quite a heavy final day. They had 8 stages in the final day. No, they were short stages, but it was in terms of the time, it was a long enough all day, which is kind of and very unusual these days, where Sunday's kind of like a half day almost in the interest of Italian stuff. But 22 stages overall and 341 kilometers overall stage length in that, based out of Limassol, I think. And on the coast or near the coast, but and a lot of stages up in the mountains. As we said, that surface was just, oh man, big massive rocks, like nearly worse than the Acropolis and the Safari in some spots. Like, and the dust was just insane as well.
I think the technical nature of it as well, because you're looking at something like the Acropolis. The Acropolis sometimes appears to be kind of a quick enough rally, because it all seems, if you look even at the onboards, the road seems to be narrowing on top of them. So if there's a rock there, there's no avoiding it. Whereas you'd see on the Acropolis, they might be able to adjust their line a bit somewhere. But this is all slow corner into slow corner. I don't think there's any avoiding it.
You know, there's like sometimes, when the Acropolis used to be a world championship event, there was always a stage or two that did kind of go up the mountains and had a section of hairpins or whatever. Every rally on this stage just seemed to be like that section of a stage on the Acropolis, repeated.
It reminds you of downhill mountain biking in parts. It's just turning round trees. That's all it seems to be in some of these stages.
Yeah, it's a very tough one and a very, you know, attrition heavy event, as we were to find out. But
I'm just looking at average speeds here. Like, the winning average speed was 66 kilometers an hour.
It's barely crawling speed, like, relatively speed.
Grim enough, like.
The first day, like, did 6 stages and it was 137k, but the longest one of those stages was 35 kilometers. And, you know, like, you have to take your hat off, like, you know, when you see how how athletic drivers are nowadays. And, you know, if you have to give credit to the guys back then, they obviously were looking after themselves to be able to perform for the 35K in those technical kind of stages with very rudimentary cooling systems inside in the car.
It's something like that. They seem to, I suppose, in the interest of weight saving and not to be drawing power from the engine with aircon or whatever. I know they have some, you know, kind of setups in endurance racing and stuff like that, but it's something that seemed to be ignored a bit in rallying. I know Sparco used to do a kind of a cooled underwear kind of a setup, but it's something that you'd imagine would negatively affect someone's performance if they were fucking on the verge of a few
years down the line, with the donkey that was the 307 World Rally Car, that had air conditioning.
Hmm? Burns had a Peugeot as well. They only had it in his car, I think. I think it was 2002. There was one of the rallies. Burns had the aircon in the car, and it did draw. They were saying on the power in the car, but
yeah,
there was obviously a comfort element to it as well.
They definitely had it in the 307 anyway. It had air conditioning.
Good God. That could, yeah. Air conditioning with only 4-speed gearbox. Actually, on the subject of Peugeot, this is the debut for the official second evolution of the 206. They'd been kind of tweaking the Evo 1, as we'll call it, for now, car since its debut in 99. They had a new engine in Catalonia in 2000, and they'd brought out the steering wheel, mounted gear change, and all those other bits and pieces throughout the season. But this was the first kind of defined homologation. And I think the first rally, oh no, the 5-speed gearbox was different. It was the first WRC car that went back to 5-speed. But
yeah, the first one went, apparently Rovan Perry in Argentina ran the 5-speed box as a test or whatever. They all ran the 5-speed box, and that was the homologated box then for the Evo 2 car. Had a different bonnet and ventilation to help with cooling, although that didn't help one of the drivers, as we'll see later on. And just very small tweaks, really. But it was enough to obviously necessitate a I don't know how you call it, not a joke, or a variant option or something like that. It just shows
how strong the Peugeot engine was at the time as well. That they were confident enough to drop a ratio. You could hear it in the sound of the car as well, obviously, with the gears being that bit longer. And, you know, it sounded a little bit different, but like...
And it was... They were a little bit ahead of their time. Obviously, they kind of took the piss out of it a few years later when they did go back temporarily to a 4-speed box in the 307. But Ford, in the later years of the Focus, the 06 to 10 Focus, that ended up with a 5-speed box.
The Lancer as well, the 05.
Yeah.
Lancer had a 5-speed box, yeah. And the Fabia, actually, the last of the Fabias was 5-speed as well, from what I recall. So there was obviously, there's benefits there. You could run stronger gears, and, you know, you can kind of reduce, I suppose, weight and things like that as well. So it all kind of, there is benefits to it if the engine is strong enough to cope with the drop of a ratio.
Am I right in saying that it was homologated with both, though, the second evolution? Because I know that there was a round later in the year where one of the drivers was arguing to run his car with the 6-speed box. I think it was on tarmac.
Interesting.
Probably could have, because the box would have been...
The
older box would have been homologated, so in theory there would have been nothing wrong with using it. And it probably was, like, if you ever look at a homologation form or that kind of, there is all those variant options, you know, like when you could get the big brake kit for a Group N Evo and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There was nothing to stop you running the smaller brakes if you wanted. So I would imagine it was...
I'd like to make my car less competitive and run the bad parts. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it was Ariel that was complaining about the box and wanted to change the 6-speed. I'm just going to take a wild guess. We'll see.
Speaking of Ariel, wherever he bought his sunglasses, that must have been the only sunglasses shop in the airport in Cyprus, because everyone was wearing those horrible... remember remember, like, in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a phase of, like, inflatable aliens that had sunglasses.
They were the exact same, weren't they? Yeah.
They were the exact same, but everyone had them in this.
Do you know who also had them? Darude.
Darude, yeah.
Darude had those sunglasses in the video for Sandstorm.
Who the ones that had? Bomb Funk MCs as well.
The fucking Bomb Funk MCs, yeah, with the freestyling.
God damn. Everyone was wearing the worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wraparound sunglasses, you could see from David Richards to Corrado Provera to Colin McRae, they were all wearing them. So,
yeah.
But Ariel started that trend.
He is at fault for lots of things, not least the sunglasses. But sure, look, we'll plow on, sure, with the rally, will we?
Yeah,
do you want to leave service and actually go to the stage? We will, that's what we'll do. Yeah.
Go for it, yeah.
So obviously running order was critical with the amount that there was gravel around. So the first day was a bit topsy-turvy. Mackinnon was having a nightmare. He was away back the order. Solberg was quickest in the first stage, followed by Kenneth Eriksson. So interesting, you know, obviously the raw position was helping them, but Solberg was actually going really, really well in the first day. He had problems with his intercom, I think, in the second stage, and his power steering went. But I think on stage four,
he had two fastest times, yeah.
And stage four, he was quickest by 21 seconds. He took fucking 21 seconds out of everyone. Delacour was second quickest. That's some going, like, especially on, you know, it was only a 20-kilometer stage, like, so that was, he was obviously fairly fired up after losing the time earlier on.
And he probably had 10 or 12 cars clearing the road in front of him. But
he was in 14th or 13th.
Yeah, take nothing away from him. It was good going. You had a couple of odd ones. Gilles Panizzi matched Granholm's time on the first stage, and was tied in fourth place in a Grafoni run 206. Not even a works car.
Yeah.
Now he faded off fairly quick. He didn't see the end of the first day.
But punctures were his undoing, I think.
Yeah, and you kind of see that a bit as this season and the following season too. Panizzi wasn't afraid. He did a safari. I think he punched the head off someone in the middle of it. But he wasn't afraid of those rougher events and developed into a pretty good driver at the end of it. But there was just hints of it coming through there on those early stages.
It's interesting to note that with Panizzi, because I think whenever he started, you know, in the full factory team, as in with the World Rally Car, the talk at the time was that he was obviously fantastic on dry tarmac, but whenever the going got a bit slippy, you'd see him. It probably explains a bit why he never went on that well in the Monte in his time with Peugeot. He wasn't able to adapt to the slippy conditions as well as the likes of Delacour or whoever. But as you said, it's interesting to see him doing pretty well there on an event that was pretty much polar opposite to what he'd wanted, or what he'd been quick on in the past.
The two Skodas had a shocker. Nothing wrong with them, but they were 20th and 21st after the first stage.
They were just bedding themselves in.
Yeah.
Just slowly.
Then on the first stage, Hamid Al-Wahibi burned a P2000 to the ground on stage one. So half the field got a time and half the field got a nominal time as a P2000 burned to the ground.
I have an awful feeling that, no, I don't. I'm thinking of the wrong car. It's actually Ackham Martin's car that became Nisbet's X22.
Yeah, but Martin drove this car, I think, on a rally too. And Frederick Dore, actually, a sponsor. Yeah. X10 WRC, but this was the last event that did anyway. Got as far as a bit through stage one, and then she went up. So
she went. And the subject of fire, actually, Solberg's yoke burnt out pretty quickly as well, didn't it?
Prop shaft, I think, because I was listening to Solberg and he said he had noise from underneath the car. So if something was flailing around, it was more than likely the prop shaft.
Yeah.
I it's probably very mean because I know English isn't his first language, but I loved in the interview. He made two attempts at trying to say the word extinguisher, and then just gave out and called it the fire thing. It's just, but like, where that car went up, like in a forest and on the road, that could have been, I remember a few years ago, was it whose car went on fire? Hayden Paddens, and it nearly burned down half of Sardinia.
Yeah, and we've seen it in the previous rally in Argentina as well, where a spectator's car went up. We even see it in the Monte last year, in the middle of fucking January. Jesus, yeah. The stage we were on, Keane actually has pictures of it. We were watching this fire, and Jesus, it's fucking scary how quick it spreads when it gets a bit of dry, kind of vegetation.
Yeah, I was amazed, and well, thankfully it didn't. I'm just watching it back, I was amazed the fire didn't spread anymore, that it wasn't a bigger deal. And what always amazes me about this 2001 coverage in particular, it seems to be 2001. Anytime a driver had an accident in a stage, or their car burned down, or they had a problem on a road section, they always got a camera and a microphone there.
They did, actually, yeah. It's a good point. Yeah.
They weren't afraid to ask them. But there wasn't a PR person around them.
There had to have been, like, the helicopter that was doing the helicopter footage had to go down and land in the middle of a stage. Like, they're interviewing someone early on in this, I think it might be Harry Ravenpera, who retires on stage 2. In the middle of a stage, they get a camera to him as the stage is live, and a group in car goes by and just absolutely piss everyone in dust. How they got down to it, I don't know, but they always seem to get it. And with pretty much all of the major retirements or the major stories on a road section, they always had a camera there.
And it was nice to see that as well, because like you forget sometimes watching coverage, especially these kind of events, how much more there is to rallying than just the stages themselves. Like, you know yourselves, if you're doing a rally, it's a full weekend of the build-up and the wrecking and the scrutiny and the road section and service and all that crack. And, you know, to me, it's all part of it. Like, you know, obviously the stages are the main element to it. Like, but there's all this other stuff that kind of gets forgotten about. So it's cool to see it on the coverage as well.
And they left it in some bits of the coverage when someone's having some moment on the in-car camera was still running, like on road sections, and you can hear them making phone calls to the engineers. I think now on the modern cars, I could be wrong, when they go over the stage finish board and they switch it on to road mode or turn off the anti-lag, that it stops the recording to the audio. That seems to happen in the new cars. You never get the chit chat down to the stop car.
You'd wonder, is there a touch of that because of the fact that with WRC live that the feed could still be inside in the car?
Yeah, quite possibly. It would certainly make sense, but there's a couple of times in this, there's like Burns chats to, or Burns finishes the stage, I forget when it is, it's a bit later on, and he goes, beat that car, lass, like just as he crosses the line and he's switching everything off. You don't hear anymore.
Channel 4, I remember, I think it was Acropolis on the Sunday one time, they were talking to McRae on the road section. They were able to feed to the footage of him, you know, leaving service, going out. Because, you know, so I'd say they probably had more control over, you know, when it was left on and not. Because there was footage as well of, I remember, was it Alistair McRae on the, when he was at Mitsubishi, and they left the camera on, and he, after the finish control, he burst into both the bathroom, and they're radioing through, where's Alistair? Oh, he just had to go X, Y, or Z place.
We were living in the future in 2001.
We were. That's a scary thing to say, Art, but you look at rallying, and without wanting to sound like the fella who travelled from Harrogate, and, you know, nothing was ever as good as when he was sleeping in his Cortina for 9 days in a row with only a tin of beans to live off to watch the rally. But we almost felt, when you look back at it now, it almost seems rallying was slightly more modern than it is now in some bizarre, strange way, because there was more modern shit. I think it might be more due to the fact that homologation was available to everybody and you could theoretically have a Group A car, a Group N car, you know, within the range of your budget, as opposed to everybody just throwing their money down the pit of a Millington Escort.
No, it's a valid point, as we've kind of touched on in numerous previous episodes. Like, the cars, they were really pushing the boundaries of technology with what they were allowed to do, like the differentials were definitely more sophisticated back then than they are now. I know they've gone back to active center discs with the current cars, but you know, the capabilities of what the cars could do back then was unbelievable. Like, even like, I'm going to bring up the Corolla again because I just love Corollas. But actually had a conversation with one of the lads during the week about the anti-lag and the launch control and the last of the Corollas, like, and how they were able to utilize the three diffs. And, you know, it was just crazy stuff, like everything working together to get the car off the line as quickly as possible. And the difference between the last of them and the first of the Corollas, in the 2 or 3 years they were competing, there was a huge jump even then. And we were seeing that pretty much every car at this stage was fully active. And as I said, the capability they had was just off the scale. The cars evolved from this year on till 2005 or 6 or whatever, till the rules kind of changed around in regarding the diffs and stuff. They focus a lot more on the aero and the kind of center of gravity and the weight distribution. Well,
do you know when teams really started to, and it was no coincidence, teams started to experiment with aero a lot more from 2003, like with the Ford Focus being the most obvious exponent of that. The Safari wasn't around anymore after 2002. So you didn't need to build a car that was capable of big high clearance or had to be a complete all round, because the Safari really was like a standalone event in terms of what you needed, like with snorkels and everything like that.
Exactly. It was a proper Safari back then too, like, yeah, you know, compared to what they're planning now.
You couldn't have had, you know, weird bumpers that would have been falling off all the time and stuff. You had to have a practical car too. And it was no coincidence that when the Safari left the calendar, you know, in 2003, 2002 was the last year it was a counting round, that the cars did then start to become a bit more extreme, because they only ever had to do, like, Cyprus or the Acropolis was the roughest thing they were going to do.
The testing programs that some of the teams used to undertake for Safari were ridiculous. What the likes of Toyota and Mitsubishi used to do were crazy. When Mitsubishi won it in 96, with Mäkinen and Evo 3, I have a copy of Rally Sport that I got when I was a child, and I always remember reading it repetitively. They brought out two cars and broke them. They basically tested everything to absolute destruction to win the Safari. Now, when you don't have a rally, like you say, of that magnitude, where you need to have your car designed with those specific issues that you potentially could encounter, but also when you don't have necessarily got to go and do that kind of testing and, you know, have to absorb that kind of money in what will eventually be scrap afterwards because you've driven it to destruction. It was obviously going to be allocated into making these cars all the more aero efficient and lower the center of gravity.
The Japanese manufacturers especially were throwing, you know, it was obviously a very prestigious event for them to win from a marketing standpoint. So like Toyota used to have basically what amounted to a satellite team based over there for months and months of the year.
They had a full workshop in
Nairobi,
in Kenya. Nicky Grish talks about it in that podcast with Chris Harris, which is 3.5 hours of brilliance. But like, the budgets had to have been astronomical.
Yeah. To just go back to your point, Tommy, on York's kind of appearing almost more modern than what we have now. It's a very good point, and I think it's relative to what was out at the time on road cars, right? Whereas, you know, you're coming off the back of a golden period for kind of competition inspired road cars with all the Group A homologation cars, right? But your, you know, typical day to day road car at the time, because we were in Ireland, was invariably a Toyota of some sort or an Opel or something, right? And it was fine. It was, you know, it was transport. It got you from A to B. If you were lucky, you might have had something a bit more special at the time or whatever. But these things, compared to what we had on the road, even though they were kind of, you know, there was a bit of a connection there somewhere.
A Peugeot 206 Gran Turismo.
Yeah.
You know, the big bumpers.
That kind of stuff, right? But like, you know, all of a sudden you had this WRC car that had like a digital dash, semi-automatic gearbox, big hydraulic handbrake sticking up out of the tunnel, four-wheel drive, active diffs, you know, all this crazy stuff. Whereas at the time, road cars were, you know, invariably normally aspirated. They had, you know, generally had two-wheel drive unless you had a Subaru or something like that, or a Jeep or whatever the case was. Whereas now, everything is obviously moved on because, you know, and motorsport does trickle down eventually into road car development to work on with small capacity turbo engines. More or less every car has a screen of some sort in the middle of the dash. Some cars even have digital dashes, no, you know, TFT screens, whatever the case may be. So maybe stuff doesn't seem as kind of cutting edge in competition now because it's trickled down over the years into the road cars. But definitely, I agree with you, Tommy, back then it did seem a lot more kind of space age than some of the stuff now.
Felt more relevant. I think that's probably because we're coming off the back of Formula 2, and I think it's, yeah, the Formula 2 element and the Group A element that had just preceded this early World Rally carrier, the fact that the cars were still very recognisable by their road counterparts, that made the cars feel more connected with reality. I think that's really, and but even, you know, at a privateer level, you know, like, there was just a lot more going on. But look, we could go down an awful wormhole with this.
This reminds me of The Simpsons with Itchy and Scratchy. So do you remember that episode where they're trying to decipher what the kids want from Itchy and Scratchy in The Simpsons? And it's like, so you want crazy fantasy fucking robots with more realistic plot lines, are like, yeah. You know, so this is the same. We want cars that are relevant to road cars, but we also want them to be absolute fucking rocket ships with the latest in technology. So we're a hard bunch to please now, to be fair.
More power than grip. That's what you need. More power than grip.
Yeah, it all boils down to that, to be fair.
At the end of day one, it looked like Granholm was potentially starting to turn the season around. It was a huge event for him.
Yeah, he was having clutch issues. And like he was, but he benefited from the road position that day. There was no doubt about it. It was like, you know, he started the rally 12th in the championship. So, but I think he seemed a lot more confident in this rally than he had been. You know,
there was definitely a question mark though at the time over the fragility of the 206, and it was to be proven. Robin Baer had went out in stage two with broken suspension. It had a fairly small tip, and that put him out. It wasn't, you know, what you'd call it might have been a rally ending impact in another car like the Lancer or whatever, but it broke his suspension in the 206 and he was out. As you said, Granholm was having these clutch issues. Mäkinen had gone off, just a really kind of slow speed, just no grip whatsoever, kind of a very slow second gear right hander. And you could see him afterwards on the surface. The surface is just like sand. I'd say there was just no grip whatsoever. You couldn't have gone slow enough around it, but off he went and just got the car stuck down by trees, just couldn't get it out. And he uttered the infamous Finnish swear word, perkele, which if we've anyone from Finland, they might let us know what the exact meaning of it is. I think it might be, you might have a couple of different meanings, none too nice, let's put it that way. But anyway, so obviously frustrated, and he could see his championship lead starting to evaporate before his eyes, because, you know, he knew that Sainz was going to go well in the event and probably take a few points out of him and stuff. McRae was really lucky. McRae had an ECU issue, and the car stopped coming into service. He got it in. They were lucky enough that wherever it stopped it, they were able to get it back in without getting any penalties or even retiring. So he was lucky to get that changed out. And Auriel was having handling issues. Not really sure the detail on that. Could have just been Auriel being Auriel and fussy, but hard to know.
Delacorte was having a very good day, despite ripping off the gear stick in frustration at his mistake.
Oh, yeah.
And going into a field, and he was in third, 11 seconds off the lead at the end of the day, which is, I think Auriel had...
He fancied problem. Himself for this rally, though, Delacorte. No, he really fancied it.
Delacorte would fancy himself in any rally, in any car.
Still to this day, I'd imagine.
Richard Tuttle testifies to that. If you listen to the podcast with Chris Harris, he reckons Delacorte believes himself that he can still do it.
I wouldn't bet against him.
I wouldn't either.
Yeah. I think Oriel had diff problems because he mentions the next day, because he starts day two really well. He sets a really quick time. He says they changed the rear diff overnight and the car was working really well. And then
he's the fastest time actually as well.
Yeah, and then on the very next stage, then the water injection or fan didn't work and she cooked herself and that was it. So
that was
that was two of the three Peugeots out.
They must have been fucking worn from trying to do head gaskets and then locks. They were losing a car to overheating early, really. It was crazy. Whatever was going on.
Especially considering this was an upgrade, they probably should have addressed some of those issues. But
Well, to be fair, if you have a car that's kind of marginal and cooling at all, this kind of rally is the one that's going to.
Yeah, it's not going to be your friend.
Yeah. No, far from it.
Carlos ended day one, sixth overall, suffered in the same way that Mäkinen did from road position after Mäkinen's retirement, I suppose, didn't do him any favours either. So he ended the day a minute and 25 off. So, but
at least he'd cleared up the old sciatic nerve issue anyway.
Yeah, wouldn't envy him on that one.
He'd been doing his stretches.
He was there with the slitter rolling his back on it.
But yeah,
it works, trust me.
good time from Tashi there on the last stage. Tashi was having a decent rally. Like this kind of rally as well, as you said, you know, it could suit a certain type of driver who mightn't have had, you know, the most experience once you could get around it all. You were with a shout of a result. You know, obviously in some of the quicker rallies, experience would count for an awful lot, and you know, you can only get that through a couple of years of going to them consistently and whatever. So, but this kind of rally did allow the guys who were maybe a little bit more careful or prone to kind of backing off, or others mightn't have, Joe, did allow them to shine to it. So, fair play to them. Good old driving.
I think
it was also a new rally in the count. Like, it had only run in WRC form the year previous, and that was it. So, it wasn't one that anyone had loads of experience on. Although Armin Schwartz won it before when it was a European event, and there's a couple of odd winners back when it was a European event, but it was one that not many would have had experience of as well.
Yeah. What did it replace actually when it came in? I was trying to figure that out.
Indonesia.
Was it Indonesia?
No, it wasn't Indonesia, it was China.
Oh, okay. Yeah, China.
It was a last minute kind of substitution in 2000 because they couldn't make China happen.
Oh,
okay, interesting.
Rally China ran through a bit of Wuhan as well, didn't it? Wuhan province.
Did it?
In 99, they had big problems with, because of the fact that some of the areas were on very high ground, they were arguing that they wouldn't run some of the stages because the safety chopper couldn't get out there.
Too kind of foggy and stuff, was it?
Yeah, but you had some teams that were, all right, that's fair enough, and then there was some teams saying, well, look, we go to Monte Carlo every year and we encounter the same thing, and sometimes the choppers kind of go up by, what's the difference, they were saying. Mm. So, but
I think the issues with spectators as well, George, I think it was kind of a new event in that region, and I'd say they mightn't have been, you know, the control mightn't have been all that great, but I don't think anyone was too happy with that rally back then. So there was obviously a drive to probably move away from it, and Cyprus was, as you said, a well established European championship event at that stage, and it wouldn't have taken, you know, a major effort, relatively speaking, to progress to world level. But
Did you touch on it already about Kenneth Eriksson? Obviously, he'd been up to second early on in the rally. Like, he was actually having a really good opening day. And in fairness, Hyundai, with the latest evolution of the car, had been, there was marked improvements on the original that had come out of NSD. But by the end of the day, it just seemed to be unravelling for him there. The turbo boost issue, he'd fallen back to eighth. But it was an impressive performance for a car that you wouldn't have fancied to it. But then again, not being a high speed car, we've mentioned it before, that it tended to suffer in the high speed rallies.
I think the turbo boost issue was pretty the cause was pretty fundamental. I think it was a fairly huge hole in the manifold was causing that, so there was no gas actually getting to the turbo to create any boost. So
did he have that issue on day one?
Was that day two? I just ruined
No, I think it's about 5 to 12 anyway, Cyprus time, so we're near enough to day 2 now.
Are we? Okay, I'm joking. Yeah, we're near. Yeah, I'm not going to lie, my notes are not up to their usual standard for Cyprus. I fucking flat out at work all week, so I haven't had much of a chance to kind of review it, but I'm counting on the two of you, and to be fair to you, you're coming up trumps to rescue this shambles of a podcast.
We can edit out that bit and we can say
I might not even have time to edit stuff this week. Everything might just get the fucking get uploaded, and we'll deal with the fallout after. But anyway, so yeah, the story day two, I suppose, looks to be that it was a Burns and McRae kind of tit for tat all day, kind of a thing, which was, you know, this is, as we said, this is the kind of rally that suited those guys.
And it was a rotten day. It was four stages, one service, four stages. So there's only one service during the day. If anything went wrong, the first two, three stages, you weren't bothered.
It was definitely, four without service. I'm not sure now, did I see where they were allowed something on this? Because it was four stages repeated twice, if you want to correct.
Yeah, that's right, there.
But yeah, because I think, who was it was in trouble? Delacour, he burst one tyre, and then when he went for the spare, he realised the spare wasn't brilliant either, so he kind of had to have a show a bit of sense in his driving for the rest of the loop, you know. Like,
yeah.
But I suppose you're in pre-Super Rally days, and this is the beauty of it. There was no Super Rally. Lads had to manage their pace. You know, you had to be there. You know, and that's what's actually quite nice about looking back on this. Taking a slight tangent there, but yeah,
Delacour
suffered with that as well.
Yeah,
I like you're talking about pre-Super Rally and the beauty of it. I was just looking back there. Stage two out of an entry of 76, 10 cars retired.
Oh man, would you be seeking after giving Freddie Dorr about $5,000 to get the car over there in the first place?
Fucking yeah, but those 10 drivers could be the same 10 drivers that would retire on every rally.
Maybe.
Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Like, you're going to always have, you know, guys that, yeah, he's going to go off. You know what?
for little Johnny Clubman at the back there in the Suzuki Baleno.
Yeah.
He wants to get home. Like.
He wants to get home. Jesus, there's nothing worse than retiring early on a rally where, like, you were never going to have a decent result anyway. You were just doing it for the crack and to get around and have fun. And going out on the second or third stage with a stupid issue like that, or worse, putting New York off like this.
Or like Hamid Al-Wahibi, she burns to the ground.
Yeah, just absolutely finished New York off for good, like she's no more good. A reshell wouldn't even start it.
Rally 2 wouldn't be a concern then, but yeah.
Interesting one with Delacour, actually, like, and this ties kind of into, you know, the issues that Ford were having with the Focus and reliability. His engine went. Because I'm an idiot, and instead of watching the 2001 Cyprus Rally, I kind of went down a bit of a 2000 season rabbit hole there at the weekend, for half an hour. And Jesus, they had some bad run. McRae was not far off leaving Ford, I'd imagine, you know, at one point, because I'd say he was just so fed up with the York breaking, and it wasn't just him, his car, like, you know, McRae lost a shot at the title in 2000. You know, because of obviously he the big off in Corsica, but he was still there thereabouts towards with a couple of runs to go, and the car left him down. And as this is again, you know, maybe it's probably more prevalent back then. It's the same with F1 and stuff. You don't see stuff breaking as much in a fundamental manner anymore. It's rare enough you see the spectacular engine blowouts of times past, and it's probably the same with rallying.
But the electronics have come on so far in the 19 years that we've seen between now and then. And it's like you just said about the engines don't blow up in Formula 1. Peugeot, I think, when they had, was it at McLaren or when they were at Jordan, they had some kind of a fail-safe in it to stop the car having the massive explosion when the engine blew. And that was why I've gone completely on a tangent, but it just buys into what you're saying there, Morris.
I'm liking this tangent, because if there's one thing that's kind of emblematic of 90s F1, it's that, you know, crazy explosion and fire and just burning oil and bits of engine.
Usually a Peugeot engine car as well.
Just that reminded me of it. Martin Brundle's book there, he does a very funny, he describes it very funny when the Peugeot engine was in the back of the McLaren in 94, that it had a, not only would the engine blow, it would also do some interesting things. It spit the flywheel down through the casing and onto the tarmac. The flywheel would then bounce back up and put itself through the box. You know, it's just a seriously bad fucking design.
But Rubens Barrichello was lying third in Hungary in 1995, just staying on the one tangent.
Yeah.
And as you exit the final corner down the main straight, the engine detonated itself. But if the engine detonated itself in the way it used to, you could still drive it with the thing blowing up down over the finish line. He went from third, I think, to was either sixth or seventh in down the straight because the engine cut itself.
Yeah.
So Peugeot couldn't be shown on TV having the massive blow up.
To switch it back around, all the engine failures here were very undramatic, including Delacour's one. Just seemed to happen on a road section.
Mm. It did actually, just the York last oil pressure or whatever. Yeah, you'd miss a good fucking blow up, like, wouldn't you? A rod fucking gone into orbit or whatever. Like, that's what you want to see. Like. But no, it doesn't seem to happen as much anymore.
A good bit of violence in our motorsport. That's what we want.
Yeah. Just proper explosions. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Another early day two retirement there as well. I'm just looking. It was Neil Wearden, first World Rally Championship event in a World Rally car, and after that season, he kind of vanished off the face of the earth. But it was the start of what at the time for him would have been quite a big campaign. I think he did four or five events that year, but that one didn't end too well anyway. I think gearbox failure on the first stage of day two.
Did he have some kind of company behind him? Were they called Pinnacle or something like that?
Slipstream Sports.
Slipstream, Sports. That's it. Yeah,
but I think himself and Agnew created that themselves, and they got people to invest in that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was an interview about it recently, and they went and they got people to invest in them, and they had the money to do 2000, and they had the money to do 2001 as well, and apparently after 9/11.
Everything just tanked after that.
The investor pulled out and never did the 2002 season. So
it's weird. He was a good driver.
He won and led international rallies against very competitive drivers back in
the BRC's heyday, like with the Formula 2 cars. Yeah. So
sponsored by Dennis Canan Motors of Thurles one weekend, if I remember rightly. when he had the EK4 Civic, because they did Asquith, I think, came over and did some of the Irish Tarmac Championship in 97. Yeah, and you'd see it on the different rounds. You'd have different dealers from the Honda network in Ireland seem to pop up in it. And North Tipperary rallying fucking wasteland for you to see suddenly Dennis Canan Motors pop up on a rally car, let alone BRC competitive car.
That's a very Tipperary-centric ad.
Hugely.
Yourself and Lowry appreciate that, I'd say, did you?
I actually think that car, wasn't it an OKE Reg Civic? I think that ended up in Tipperary or Cork in the end up anyway.
Well, I know that listener to the podcast, shout out to David Fleming down in Killarney. David, who should have been getting married there a week or so ago, only for our COVID-19. David has been on to Neil Brown Engineering, who would have built the engines on several occasions, just trying to get more data on that car because he has an EK4 himself. So he would have done a good bit of research into that car. But I think you're right, that car did make its way into Ireland at some stage.
Yeah, it was yellow at a time anyway. It was definitely...
There was another car that Alistair McRae had rallied, the left-hand drive one.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, is it the same one? That's the only thing.
Weirden was a very good driver, but this was the beginning of the end for him in a weird way, looking back on it.
Would you say in a Weirden way?
Hey... No,
really bad. That's probably one of the worst jokes we've had. Anyway, let's in the interest of time, let's keep it rolling and then just to move on from that terrible.
Roll it there, Colette.
I might just fucking give up altogether. Just hand the reins over to Andy. You can fucking do it from now on. Anyway, so yeah, we're on to day three, and McRae was after strategically dropping time and the last stage. He was sketchy enough maneuver to be doing. You know, they were all at the time. The way the rope position worked, it was leader first on each subsequent day, which obviously was a big disadvantage on these kind of rallies. So the tactics at the time, and you'll see him in the next couple of rounds as well, was that you try and drop it. Just, you know, there was a fine balance between dropping too much time and just dropping enough to get behind the guy in front and give it just a little bit of an advantage. But McRae slowed down after the yellow board on the finish of the last stage, which is a really dodgy thing to do. Sainz actually got disqualified from Australia the previous year for stopping.
Yeah.
In that, that's technically a control. Like, so, and he was only crawling, but he got away with it anyway. And
Burns, was it not that Sainz was seen coming to a complete stop, whereas Granholm actually coasted through the control?
That was it. Yeah, Sainz actually came to a halt.
And there was video evidence of it, so he couldn't.
Not only was there video evidence, there was video evidence from the WRC TV crews. So.
Yeah.
And it came up, it could have been an earlier event this season. Peugeot miscommunicated something to Granholm. Might have been Argentina. And Rautiainen says to him, "You can't stop, you're between the boards." Peugeot got the board out far too late, whenever it was. And by the time Rautiainen had calculated how long they needed to stop for, they were past the yellow board. So they couldn't stop, so they had to get to the end, and Granholm was fuming. It might have been Argentina. It might have been the last round. I can't remember.
I think it was New Zealand. I think it was there. Is either Greece or New Zealand? Because there were two rallies where there was definitely a large amount of this kind of shenanigans going on, you know?
It got fairly toxic in the end-up.
It did, yeah. And they were doing it in Oz at the time, they did it previously in 1999, I think, and they started doing it this year again, where they allowed the running order to be dictated by the top positions and stuff. And look, it's something that still goes on to this day. The championship either getting punished on the first day, all this kind of stuff. But look,
but the running order, obviously, in Cyprus, had a major bearing on how things were turning out, because on day two, Granholm had led overnight. He was losing up to 2 seconds a kilometre. But I suppose the big winner in terms of road order was Sainz. Sainz had started the day on day two, a minute and 25 off the lead. He started day three, only 24.6 off the lead. He had 6 fastest times out of the 8 stages on the Saturday, to make up a minute purely, wasn't all road position, pace as well. Sainz, he'd won the rally the year before, so yeah. It's been proven he was no slouch, so he put himself into the fight really for the rally going into day three as well.
It was interesting to see a relatively close kind of gap between the top three or four, as you said, they were going into the final day, and this kind of event would usually end up with bigger margins than this.
With a long endurance event, not an endurance event, but a particularly tough event, you would allow for punctures and fellas hitting bother in 30, 40 second gaps. Now, look at the heading into the end of leg two, you had very little cover in
25 seconds in the top four,
it's very little, and that set it up for a nice final day, really. And even on the final day, there was a couple of swings.
To be fair to Freddie Likes, he'd had a fairly Cat David in terms of brake and drive shafts and half spins and things like that. He saw him about 4 to 5 minutes off the lead. But I think the fact that he was the sole remaining point scoring Mitsubishi, a finish was probably the most prominent thing they needed at that stage, because if you look at Toshi Arai lying ahead of him in fifth going into the start of day three, Arai wasn't registered for points. The manufacturers, so just looking at that picture.
Yeah, the Lancer was doing, or the Charisma, as they called it back then, in a kind of a marketing thing, and calling the road car the Charisma was a bit of an oxymoron when you look at it. The least charismatic road car, one of the least charismatic road cars ever built. But anyway, it was doing its usual trick of being just a wanker of a York to drive and breaking drive shafts and stuff like that. So it mustn't have been the nicest spin around inside it. But as I said, the last day, there was 8 stages, which was unusual. But the distance was quite short. There was less than 100 kilometers of stage mileage. So, you know, almost like a 1 day event over here or whatever, but turned up to double the temperature. Granholm was suffering. Like, this is the thing, Peugeot, like, they really were dropping the ball. Throws in one of it, as we mentioned before, with reliability. Granholm went out with, I think, fuel pressure. They just couldn't, I don't know, it was an issue with the pump or something like that. But he was out. Another just silly retirement for you know.
It also seemed to be a rally too, Mars, where it seemed to lean more towards favouring the Pirellis as well. Like, he went fastest on the first stage the morning, Granholm did, but he wrecked the tyres doing it. He was trying to manage them from there on. But like, if you look at, like, even you see the likes of Toshi Arai set a second fastest time on the final stage of day two. It was a Pirelli rally.
No, totally, yeah. They were definitely the as we say, this is another interesting variable at the time, was the differences in tyres and different rallies. And even stage to stage, in some cases, you know, you had tyres that suited one stage better than the other. And so it's just another exciting element to it. But
no John Colloway's or Silverstone's, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, the best of the best. But anyway, and there's nobody
Max,
running.
Max Sport.
First
rally I ever did is on a set of Max Sport tyres and chewing gum. Horrible.
Did you have maximum sport with them?
No, I had maximum nothing with them.
Maximum lack of grip.
They were on the car and I didn't care. And yeah. It was the first rally and I just wanted to finish, which I didn't even bloody do. But I think I'd go fair to say they're the worst tyres I've ever driven on.
That's the joke. Even road car tyres, like?
Yeah.
Jesus, that's some going, doesn't that? Most of the best of the tyres. I was saying, William tried an experiment there on the Stone Trails 1 year, just out of pure, as we mentioned in the last episode. Budgetary constraints. There was a Dunlop on the back left and a Pirelli in the back right, and there was, shall we say, interesting handling characteristics resulting from that, which are lucky got.
I remember seeing that leaving service, and I kind of said to him, like, have you the pressure set differently, because you know that they're going to come up slightly different
compound. Yeah, like, oh, that's just amateur horror. I'm sure we had a bit of crack in it. I didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. That was my first rally, actually. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I'm sure we got around.
There was a lot of William Nolan style activity on the road sections as well, as you can see. William making his presence known on this podcast despite his absence. They were all swapping the tyres from back to front. You could see that throughout the rally, just to try and manage the tyre wear. I suppose it says more about how the cars were handling, that they were leaning so heavily on the front of them in terms of the cornering.
And obviously, certain cars and drivers were tougher on the tyres than others. And then you had the look factor as well. You know, obviously, they were allowed to run the moose back then, but you know, it's debatable in these kind of conditions. How effective the moose was. I don't think there was certain temperatures where I think it obviously had an operating range or whatever, but I think on the very hot stuff, it probably wasn't as effective as it could be.
Art, do you remember? Go on, sorry.
I know that Burns was, after closing to just over 10 seconds behind McRae by the middle of the day, but then he ended up having, I think, 2 punctures, and he kind of had to preserve the car then after that and preserve his tyres after that, and that kind of tempered his pace towards the end. But
he still had to keep Sainz from nipping at him too, you know.
Yeah.
Well, he went fastest on the final stage. He took 4 seconds, but it's like you were talking as well, I think, Archie, you mentioned it, we were talking about a couple of minutes ago about the camera staying on, and inside the car they left it on with McRae and Grist. And they were saying that Grist was obviously clearly not happy with the time, something just that it wasn't what they expected. It felt the rhythm or something was wrong, and then McRae's in the distance was wrong. Because you wouldn't see that kind of thing anymore. They wouldn't show us it.
Yeah, and it's funny the little things it shows up. like, and probably there was another one that Chris says at the very end of the rally, which you wouldn't read too much into it then, but with what happened in the subsequent season or two, you would just wonder, had it been a very long week or something. It was just an odd thing to say.
I was just going to say this, right?
There was a strange undercurrent.
With the benefit of hindsight, and, you know, unfortunately, one of them isn't their own to give his side of it anymore. And obviously, look, they became good friends again after they stopped walking together back in 2002. There was definitely a bit of an atmosphere. It felt like, you know, there was McRae wasn't happy with a couple of notes. And I wonder, was it almost the beginning of the end? I know McRae was quite frustrated in this era as well. Obviously, we've said it already in this podcast, even about the Ford being unreliable and stuff like that. But there was definitely a different dynamic at play than there was.
Not to spoil it for our listeners, McRae wins the rally. At the end, you know, they do the little handshake, you know, and then Gris says, very pointedly, "Well done, pal." Just in an odd way.
We could be picking up on this completely, but the fact that the three of us have actually written this down means that we have noticed.
Yeah, and maybe it just might have been a very long week, a very long event, you know, whatever. But there was definitely some little bit. It wasn't the kind of, we've won our second rally on the bounce, championships back on track, big kind of Yahoo reaction.
Yeah.
You'd expect. It just seemed odd.
They were both very strong characters, like, and both very interesting characters. Like, Nicky is a great storyteller. As, like, if we give that podcast any more shout outs, we'll be fucking expecting royalties. But anyway.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah. But anyway, there's Tommy, will you, whatever fucking background is that you're.
That was just me scratching my bottom.
Stop scratching your bottom in the podcast, please. We've got, this is a family, it's not really a family podcast, but look, just, if you can minimize the bottom scratching until the podcast is over, that'd be great. Anyway, what were we talking about? Chris McRae.
Chris and McRae.
Yeah, McRae and Chris. Out of all the bits of in-car when I was watching it back and all the little things that were said and unsaid, that one jumped out a mile at me.
Yeah, and like you know as well from competing, Tommy, you're probably the only one of us that's done Donegal's, are you?
Yeah. Arch, you've done it, haven't you?
No, the year I did the championship, I didn't do Donegal.
It went on the pace for the weekend.
I've done Donegal, she's three or four times, yeah, one.
Yeah, so like that's the only 3-day rally over here. I've only ever done single day events, like, and you know, even after 2 days, you know, between Ricky and like, you're spending, and especially if, you know, you're stuck in the car with each other for that length of time. After, you know, in the World Championship event here, they've been together for the week now at this stage between Ricky and all the other crack. It's boiling hot. The pressure's on. You know, these guys are under, you know, they mightn't show it because they're the best of the best, but there is a huge amount of pressure on them to deliver, not only from the immediate team, but from, you know, the manufacturers as a whole, you know, right up to the top level boards of management, CEOs and stuff, like, everyone's watching them. So, you know, it's not unusual for some of that pressure to kind of come out in these kinds of ways, you know.
No, but at the same time, you would have thought the elation of winning would have overridden a lot of that. But I watched it back a few times, that particular bit, just to try and... I don't think there was anything more to read. The most interesting thing I noticed after that was probably one of the least practical sponsors in terms of the weather that they were experiencing. McRae had extra backing on his suit from Tunnock's Tea Cakes. I imagine eating one of them in a fucking Focus at 60 degrees of heat.
You need carbohydrates. The wafers give you carbohydrates.
I actually have some of them in the press. I'm going to have one after this as soon as we finish, so I'm going to wrap things up there pretty quickly.
I have a couple of Foxes Classics.
What have you got?
Foxes Classics.
Oh, serious. They're actually a serious biscuit. Are they biscuit or chocolate?
We'd call them a halfway. They're kind of like a treat bear.
They're a glorious mix of both, really, aren't they?
They're they're quite savoury, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're the Rolls Royce.
Yeah. Anyway, sure, look, we'll wrap things up. So, as we said, McRae held out to win. So, second win in the trot. So, definitely good way to get the season back on track after a pretty terrible start to the year. Burns again in second. Good result. Probably a bit disappointed that he didn't bring the win home, but still good points on the board for both him and Subaru. Signs in third again. Jesus, like, he's signed this era signs, like, he mightn't have been at the level of ultimate pace that the younger guys were at, but Jesus, like, he was just unbelievable just to bring a result home. Like,
Dennis Irwin over at
he'd stay like the mother-in-law. He was always there.
Yeah,
but a solid 8 out of 10. You know, that's what you'd always say for science. You know, and the football in parallel that you give is somebody like the likes of a Dennis Irwin or somebody.
Yeah,
just does the job right.
Interesting side note: footballing, Carlos Sainz. He did have trials for Real Madrid, I believe, back in his early days before he became.
Did he do the Formula Ford Festival as well? Did I see?
Possibly, and he also had. He was also quite calm.
Was it
squash or tennis? He was also
squash. Yeah, and he spent a summer in Dublin as a teenager learning English.
Did he?
Yeah.
He could be like Javi Alonso. Could be handy at
Gaelic
football as well.
Jesus, what an all rounder that man is.
Yeah, clogging. Well, I was going to say clogging up the dart. The dart didn't exist in the early '80s or late '70s. But do you know what you'll never see? One Spanish student.
No, you'll see 4,000 of them. But sure, look, hey, they're 4,000. Fair play to them.
But science served his apprenticeship, anyway.
Yeah, fair play to him. I just looking at the results back down. Tashi was in fourth. Fair play to him. Great result.
Super result. Yeah.
With Glenn McNeil, who went down to co-drive for another couple of notable guys following this. But great result. As I said, Tashi looked just delighted to be there. A bit like Harry Robbenpera, even after Harry retired in stage two. And looking at his championship bid, his fragile championship bid fallen somewhere before him, he was still kind of smiling and stuff. So, no, it's always nice to see.
Actually, just. Sorry there, go on ahead, Mark.
Go on. It's always nice to see guys with serious enthusiasm for the sport and just happy to be there and getting the results. It's always nice to see it, you know.
Yeah, I think he's one of the only men on that rally that did the Cork 20 as well. I mean, he did the Cork 20 in a Group N car in the late 90s.
Good shout. Yeah.
Just looking there, like what we were saying earlier in terms of, you know, throwing in the likes of Atashi Arai in the hope that they would get a result and that attrition would take hold. Like, there was 26 and a half seconds covering the top three, but then it was another 5 and a bit minutes back to Arai in fourth.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of the midfield had fallen off, and he definitely, like, he held off likes as well on the last day. Likes haven't put his troubles behind them. It was a decent enough showing, you know.
Yeah.
I have my suspicions that, look, I'm a Likes fan anyway, but I have my suspicions that Likes had to get a finish for the manufacturer on this, really, because the fact that Arai wasn't a factor in that, you know, let him have the three points. At the end of the day, it was a winner. It was a winning thing for the Japanese manufacturers as a whole, I would say, for Arai to have finished fourth, because it probably strengthened the thing at home a little bit for both organizations.
Yeah,
even if he wasn't as over, you know.
Definitely, yeah, that was a big result for one of their own at the time. So for Peyton, just looking at Pezzy Hagstrom in sixth, and the other guy, the other T guy, the fake Tony.
They're not related.
No, they're not. I think we established that already. But
check that.
So his Corolla, and now we're just getting into some serious number plate licking again, but bear with me. KAM442, so as usual, Corolla plate or TT plate, Cologne Anderson Motorsport, which is what the AM stands for. 442, why is that a number plate relevant to Irish rallying? Can anyone guess?
One of the Dandy cars, 651 was the other one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
On the ball, that was the one.
Was that Charlie's car?
It was the one they brought home when Charlie fucking threw the other one into a fucking ditch and the sucker to carry one year, the red and that's.
It was number two, car number two.
Yes. To bring, yeah, it was the first car with the paddle shift, I think, that they had. I think they put the paddle shift on 651 after that as well. I think, no, I does.
Yeah, they had the paddle. They had three ways of changing gear in them.
Yeah, I've had a spin on one and seen the three ways, and it is just mesmerizing what them yokes were able to do. Again, I have a major Corolla WRC fascination, and probably do a podcast on one in the future. I'll even do it my own. I'll fucking rattle on myself for an hour, but I don't care. You can join if you want.
The only team that got a full complement of cars home was the team that took the least cars. The two Skodas got home, 8th and 9th.
Yeah. So
I think what people tend to overlook, we all focus on Aaron Schwartz's performances because probably we've seen him do so well in Monty in the car and obviously score, you know, the bulk of their points during the year. But Thierry, you know, finished a minute up the road for him, you know, and like Thierry's performances kind of, you'd find that you might overlook them when you look at the Skoda ones. You kind of tend to more look at the Schwartz ones, but Thierry very could often be sometimes better.
Yeah, Bruno Thierry was a great driver. In fairness to him, and
still grab notes for he does grab notes for Thierry Neuville, doesn't he?
Oh, he does actually. Yeah,
yeah. But Thierry, as good and all as he was, okay, he should have won. I think it was a Corsica 96.
95.
The wheel bearing.
He should have won that, but was really never that close in any other ones. And when he dropped back to European Championship level, he was very comfortable, and he won that comfortably then 2 years later, like in 2003. And that was, again, talking of other podcasts, I think it was an Absolute Rally where Stefan Prevost was interviewed,
and
which is brutally honest. It's amazing.
It's a brilliant podcast, isn't it?
It's a great interview, that is.
Yeah, but yeah. he's on about drivers and the levels they're at. And he says, Thierry was really, really, really good, but he was never at the top level. But he was good enough to.
But look, there's plenty of drivers who that accusation could be levelled at. But at the end of the day, if they're doing a job in a team and earning a wage from it, there's a number of drivers that are probably signed on contracts to the World Rally Championship, and they know they're not going to win the World Rally Championship, but they have a team, they have a role within that team.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, there will be an occasion when the rally will fall their way and it'll happen for them. It nearly happened for Bruno Thierry on that occasion.
It could have been
the coin that had it fallen either way for him, it could have been the make or break of his career. It's all about getting that one off your back and suddenly the rest happens.
You'd be curious about, you know, Skoda's driver employment. Like, effectively, they've got two of the same driver there. You have an Armin Schwartz and a Bruno Thierry. You know, it wasn't like they had one of those experienced ones that they were trying to throw in a Petter Solberg or a Marco Martin into the mix and blood them.
The boys kind of aim for the year seem to be who could get the wildest angles coming into junctions and stuff. Like, they were both that sort of style.
I get, you know, yes, they were good team drivers, but what point was the two of them in the Skoda team? I often wonder that, but if Skoda had experimented a bit more with their driver lineup, or do you know the way, like,
the whole thing with Skoda at the time, though, as well, and Seat had just, like, the Volkswagen group had two teams, like, similar to what PSA were doing, basically competing against each other. And if they just directed the funding and maybe the expertise towards one of them and made a proper fist at it, you could have had a totally different story, because we've seen there's some brilliant guys that scored a motorsport. Like, they went on to the Fabia Sutthausen, was the class of the Sutthausen cars, the Fabia RFI, and a similar enough story in that category. Like, so there's some great brains there. Like,
it's a case of human resources as well, really, outside of who was competing there this year in terms of drivers who've been established with experience of the events. The only one that springs to mind that you could really have pulled in, which eventually they did, was Tony
Gardemeister. Yeah, it's a good point, actually. And I suppose, look, the car had its fundamental issues as well. But to your point there, like, you have these guys who know they're not going to win the championship. They know they're at that level, they're there to do a job. There's probably an argument to be said that, realistically, Roscoda ever talking about going to, you know, winning at the top level,
I suppose if you draw the comparison, again, go back to F1 with someone like Minardi, who would have like a track record of blooding young drivers,
young quick guys,
and moving them on. Like, Skoda never, but they just got experience. Like, their next step after this was to get in Stig Blomqvist, like.
And Kenneth Eriksson.
Just their driver signing them up, policy.
There's a bit of a retirement for them.
Keep Jan Kopecky or whatever and take him in for a few rallies. But it was just very curious. They didn't try and and blood anyone. They just wanted.
They brought on Roman Cresta later on the year, right?
Yeah. They're just like a big, comfy couch, and just everyone was happy and not too much stress. And
do you know what? That's the kind of team I think I'd fit right into.
Not everyone can win.
I know my limits. They're pretty.
We've one more link actually at the end of the top 10. Complete the top 10. Another Corolla World Rally car with a link to Ireland. Abdullah Bakashab. His navigator was Bobby Willis, who was and if it comes back again in whatever guise is going to be, I'm sure he probably still will be involved, the clerk of the course for the Circle of Ireland Rally.
Yes. Very good.
Tenuous, but, you know.
I know. We'll take Ireland, you know, for such a rally mad country, you know, Bear Breen and the likes of Meek, whatever, in terms of guys from the island, it's only recently we've had guys up at the very top level in a kind of a serious capacity.
Yeah.
We've always been there or thereabouts in the fringes, and it's unusual for, you know, we would have classed ourselves as having a very strong domestic championship all the way up along, but we've had very few guys actually make the leap to the very top level of the sport. So we'll take any link we
It was 30 finishers out of 76 starters.
And we have to give a notable point to one car that finished. The one car that entered in Class N1, the most basic class you can enter in international homologated rallying at that time, the Suzuki Swift, finished. Yeah. And it didn't finish last either.
No, finished third last. I had a Subaru and a Peugeot. So, yeah, that's strong. That's strong old looks. But anyway.
Gustavo Trelles with another Group N win there as well.
Yeah,
Trelles is another ex works driver, bizarrely.
Yeah,
signs a teammate at Atlantia.
Yeah. Did you get your shipment of Uruguayan meats, wines, and cheeses last week? No. Mine didn't turn up. You were after fucking neck and all, didn't you?
I made a toasted ham and cheese sandwich with mine.
Ah, sacrilege! Jeez.
Anyway. Being the bog trotter that I am, you know.
Anyway, so yeah, that's.
I didn't go quite as far as eating out of a boot of a car. I'm not that much of a Tipperary man.
Okay.
And after all of that, the championship leader at the end of the rally was still Mäkinen.
It was, because he had such a big advantage built up, and Sainz still in second, obviously. But McRae was starting to catch up then at this stage, obviously, with the two wins. So. This is the kind of season where a couple of good results had you back on track there before you knew it, because of the attrition of others or the mistakes from others or whatever. So another interesting rally, and we managed to get a fair bit of the Cyprus. And you know what, at the start of this series I was kind of not dreading, as I said, same with the coverage, not dreading Cyprus. I was like, fuck, are we going to have enough to talk about with it? And it turns out we actually had a lot to talk about, which again just shows how.
Because I'd be honest, the only Cyprus I have any. You know, you'd have a recall in your head of most. The only rally Cyprus that I have any memory of is the following year when McRae barrel rolled the Focus three times.
Yeah.
This one's also notable enough as well, because just on a kind of. Along the same lines as what we discussed last week in terms of gaming, it's the first sign we've seen of the WRC game. on the PlayStation on the covers, 2. It actually popped up in the covers there. So
it did, yeah. There's a couple of people playing it. We might touch on that now.
Might crack into the soundtrack later on for
next week. I'd be tempted.
It's a Primal Scream.
Try and break it out. But then I know I'd just be severely disappointed, as I was when I played it at the time. But anyway, sure, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in due course. But iconic images of the time from the last day. There's this kind of this long sweeping right hander into like a hairpin kind of a lift, and the dust is just unbelievable. Like I said, there was a couple of photographers and stuff there. I think I remember seeing some photos from it at the time where Burns is coming through it. And there's dust actually just shooting out of the bonnet vents and everything. Do you know, it's crazy. It's so cool to see, and out of every orifice of the car. And just, they must have had fairly decent cabin filters and stuff coming into the vent or whatever. But
your lungs must have been absolutely brown after it, though, because there was a clip as well where Burns, it was in one of the technical sections where obviously you were coming down off a height into the hairpins below or possibly climbing back up the way, and he actually got caught in his own dust.
Oh, yeah, I think I see that. It's a big thing with dust hanging in these kind of events, isn't it? Where there's much wind and it just kind of sits between the trees and stuff.
Bad enough to be stuck behind Mackinnon or somebody on the safari, but I mean, to be catching your own.
They were coming out of the car like Stirling Moss at the end of the Mille Miglia, like all dust where the Balaclava was. Like, it was,
Lord have mercy on poor old Stirling, yeah.
RIP Stirling Moss, actually.
Out of all the events in the championship so far, it was the one visibly that the drivers suffered on the most.
It was definitely a test of endurance and fitness as much as it was of the cars. And
reputedly 15 litres of fluid per day you'd have to take on.
15 litres, holy shit.
How you get time to take on 15 litres, I suppose, when you're in that situation.
Jeez, that's a lot of water, or whatever they were drinking, but anyway.
Well, I suppose when you think about it as well, like, if you've been in a rally car on a particularly hot day, or in a particularly hot rally car, like these cars with their active differentials and the power and turbo engines, stop start through all those sections, the heat that's been conducted and processed through the heavy braking and all the metal against metal, the heat that's inside in those cars is phenomenal.
Yeah, it could be up over 60 degrees. I'd say to and easy, like, and you know, you said their rally cars are hot places to be anyway, even in the cold day, like, so they're not the night, the air would be the best in the mirror, like, so.
But we don't sell it well to people, do we, really?
No, we just make it sound like misery, don't we? Yeah, but it's not too bad. It's not the worst sport, it's okay. But anyway, yeah, so that kind of wraps us up. As I said, I'm probably not going to get much chance to edit this. This might just go up as it was. So, sorry about that.
they have a short hop, skip, and a jump on another Freddy Dorr boat, probably across to Greece. Then
that's it. Yeah, over to the Acropolis, another classic event. So we'll head over there next week for another hot and dusty and sweaty.
I'll be in Ionapa for the week
Will you start your background noise when you're in Ionapa, because it's fucking scandalous.
I'll replace it with a bit of hard trance.
Just the thump of fucking
Ferry Carsten,
that's the job. Proper. Anyway, so that, as I said, that wraps up. Once again, thanks to everyone for tuning in. And keep continuing to like and subscribe and all that crack and the various platforms. I will hold my hand up and say I haven't got us up on iTunes yet, purely because I've been too busy with real life, unfortunately, at the moment. But hopefully in the next couple of days I'll get that sorted. But yeah, that's pretty much us for this week. So for myself, Morris, and from the boys, Tommy and Art, and thanks again to Art for stepping in this week. We'll have him on again in the near future again. Great addition as always, and William might be back with us next week. We'll have to see if he's done his homework or what he's doing. So, but yeah, that's us. So thanks very much, and talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening, lads. We'll put up the video footage as well in the comments as well. Thanks, guys.
Good night. Bye bye.